Welcome to Royally Screwed. My name is Chris Shearer, and it's my honor to take you on a tour through some of history's greatest, worst, and bizarre rulers. In this episode, we're taking a look at the wild life and reign of the last emperor of China, the Xuantong Emperor of Qing, more commonly known as Puyi. Now, the term last emperor of China, at least from what I saw in research, isn't necessarily 100% cut and dry as for who to say who holds that title. Nevertheless, Puyi was indeed the last man to hold the throne of emperor of China when the empire was dismantled and transformed into the semi-short-lived Republic of China, which is completely different from the modern-day communist nation of the People's Republic of China. Puyi's life would cover an era in China's history where the region underwent several massive changes to the geopolitical landscape, including the messy period before and during World War II when the Republic was being invaded by Japan. But despite everything happening around him, perhaps as a bit of a spoiler for the historical narrative you'll be hearing, Puyi would survive long enough to get a full picture of how much China changed as a nation over a fairly brief period of time. The man himself is just as intriguing as the time he lived in. We'll see how someone can go from emperor to nothing quite a few times in perhaps one of the strangest roller coasters of a human life we've covered in this show. So without further ado, let's begin the story. We're going back in time to the end of the Qing Dynasty of China in the early 1900s in the Manchukuo Candidate. Before all the revolutions that happened during Puyi's life upended everything, we need to establish some things first. First and foremost of those is actually the Qing Dynasty, which is different from the Qin Dynasty, aka the first imperial dynasty of China I covered not too long ago. I've covered more ancient emperors of China in this show, but no one this modern. Obviously, given everything I stated at the top of the show, the Qing Dynasty was the last imperial dynasty of China before the monarchy was dismantled in favor of a republic. But just who were the Qing? The Qing Dynasty was established in 1636 after a successful invasion and conquest of the Ming Dynasty. The Qing Dynasty is often noted as being of interest because its leaders were of Manchu descent rather than Han. Han Chinese currently make up an overwhelming majority of the population of China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Macau, and Singapore. They are named after the Han Dynasty, the second imperial dynasty of China. The Manchu people lived in northeastern China in the region now known as Manchuria. They spoke a separate language from Mandarin Chinese that is related to some languages spoken by the native people of Siberia. The Manchu people of China first revolted against the Ming Dynasty in the early 17th century in order to bring together all the Jurchen tribes, the former name of the Manchus, that lived under Ming dominion. The original leaders of the Manchu people were called the Jin Dynasty and referred to their leaders as Khans. It wasn't until the Jin Dynasty took control of the remains of the Yuan Dynasty, a Mongolian dynasty that came out of the splintering of the Mongolian Empire of Genghis Khan, that the leaders proclaimed themselves as emperors and renamed the dynasty to Qing. The Qing took control of China when they captured the Ming capital of Beijing in June of 1644, though it would take a few more years before the Ming were truly defeated, and the dynasty continued to rule for the next 2.5 centuries. Let's now jump forward to the late 19th century to talk about the First Sino-Japanese War. In the mid-19th century, both Qing Dynasty China and Japan were undergoing waves of westernization. With Japan, this resulted in the Meiji Restoration, the dismantling of the power of the shogun, and the return of the power of the emperor. From a modern point of view, Japan was very successful in adopting a more Western style of existence, which allowed the nation to gain a stronger foothold in the power struggles throughout Asia. Meanwhile, Qing Dynasty China was undergoing the self-strengthening movement. This movement is historically viewed as not as successful of westernization as the conservative elite within China managed to maintain a decent grip on the socio-political state of the empire. These two different levels of cultural reform resulted in Japan making a move to take control of political and cultural influence in the Korean Peninsula, something that had historically been China's game. In the 1880s, after an unclear succession to the throne of the Korean monarchy, the United States and Korea signed a treaty that recognized Korea as an independent nation within Eastern Asia. China objected to the treaty, stating that Korea was a client state of the Qing. Japan, meanwhile, viewed the situation in Korea as a situation they could take advantage of, hoping to lead a series of reforms in the nation that would allow Japan to claim the peninsula as a dependent state of its empire. Japan's hopes to gain influence over Korea and China's insistence that it still had control over the nation ultimately led to the two nations going to war with each other in July of 1894. The war would ultimately prove disastrous for the Qing dynasty. In the treaty ending the war, China had to recognize Korea as an independent nation and ceded a small section of its mainland, as well as several islands, including Taiwan, to the Japanese Empire. This continued to increase the power of influence Japan had in the region. It also created an unstable political situation in China. European powers started seeping into China, which began with an expansion of the railroad network in the nation. The citizens of China were reeling from the past few decades. Several sets of seemingly useless reforms and disastrous war efforts made it apparent that the government was not in any place to continue ruling over its people. Revolution was coming, though it would still be a while before it would fully come to fruition. And meanwhile, Japan was also continuing to ramp up its desires for total dominance in Eastern Asia. It was only a matter of time before those two ideas collided, and there was one man who was unfortunate enough to be in charge when that happened. Pu Yi was born in 1906 in an empire that was drastically attempting to change how the empire worked. In the years before his birth, his great-aunt, Empress Dowager Cixi, was the mind behind Chinese politics, using her power as a kingmaker, well, emperor-maker, to place children on the throne so she could act as their regent. She had sought to truly reform the empire in a way that would get it back to a spot of preeminence in the East Asian world. The Qing dynasty had also recently been rocked by the Boxer Rebellion, an uprising in China that was anti-foreigner interference. When the rebellion was suppressed, dissent began to grow among the people of China. However, Cixi thought for sure that the way to heal her nation was to lead a series of reforms that could do what the reforms of the mid-1800s had failed to do: westernize China in a way that it could stand toe-to-toe with the other powerful nations of the world. In 1908, the Guangxu Emperor, Cixi's nephew, died without fathering any children. As his replacement, Cixi chose Pu Yi, who was only a couple months away from turning 3 years old. On the 13th of November, Pu Yi was taken from his parents by a group of guards and court eunuchs, and he was brought before his aunt. Pu Yi would later write, "I have a dim recollection of this meeting, the shock of which left a deep impression on my memory. I remember suddenly finding myself surrounded by strangers." Of course, a two-year-old being separated from his family would be a traumatic event for anyone, let alone someone who is about to become the Emperor of China. Empress Dowager Cixi would pass away 2 days later on the 15th of November. Now, funny thing, Guangxu died the day after Pu Yi was chosen by Cixi. This has led to the somewhat obvious rumor that Cixi had the former emperor assassinated. A couple weeks later, in early December, Pu Yi was given his coronation, being proclaimed the Xuantong Emperor. His father, Prince Regent Zaifang, accompanied his son, but Pu Yi's mother was not in attendance. According to Pu Yi, his coronation was terrifying. Again, he was too. As he wrote, "It was a ceremony that I ruined with my tears." The only comforting figure in Puyi's life at this time was his wet nurse, Wang Liangshu. As a young child, the emperor began to grow a sadistic streak that only Lady Wang could control. Imagine a 2-year-old with the power of a king. You have to do anything the little kid says, even if it puts you in harm's way, otherwise it's off with your head. A common story is that he ordered court eunuchs to be beaten for his amusement. This put him in direct conflict with Empress Dowager Lung Yu, the wife of Puyi's predecessor. She would eventually force Lady Wang out of the picture when Puyi was 8 years old, stating he was too old to have a wet nurse as a companion. This would only make the child emperor even more of a pain in the butt for everyone who served him. According to Puyi, his education was extremely lacking when he was a small child, as he was only taught about classical Chinese texts. He apparently could not even locate Beijing on a map during this time due to the lack of proper teaching. Then, in 1911, another rebellion arose in China, this one calling for an end to the Qing dynasty. Empress Dowager Lung Yu sent General Yuan Shikai to take care of the rebellion in the south, but he was unable to stop the growing calls for a Chinese republic. This marked the beginning of a long end for Puyi, and he was still only just 5 years old. As part of the demands of the Xinhai Revolution, the rebellion of 1911, Puyi was forced to abdicate the throne of Emperor of the Qing Dynasty. Well, mostly. Though he was no longer the de facto leader of the new Chinese Republic, Puyi was allowed to live in the Forbidden City, the imperial palace of the emperor. He also still held his title of emperor, that title just didn't mean anything anymore. The rules of the Republic allowed Puyi to be given the same respect as would be given to a foreign leader. He's a Chinese noble, still living in China, but is being treated like he's from a different nation. I mean, technically, he was. The Qing Dynasty and the Republic of China were different nations, even if they happened to occupy the same land. Now, here's something that gives us a different perspective on the Xinhai Revolution. Yuan Shikai, the man put in charge of the imperial army, was never actually planning on putting down the rebellion. He had once been kicked out of the imperial court and held a grudge against the empire. He had been approached by revolutionaries and given the proposal that he would be president of China if the Xinhai Revolution succeeded. Yuan then convinced the nobility that their military efforts were a lost cause. True to their word, Yuan Shikai was then made president of the new Republic of China. However, President Yuan had his own personal goals for his leadership. It did not take too long before it became apparent he was planning on re-establishing a monarchy, this time with himself as Emperor of China. He gained enough support that in December of 1915, he was indeed crowned as the new emperor of a new Chinese empire. As a child looking on all this, Puyi was furious, because wasn't he supposed to be emperor? Before Yuan was crowned, the child emperor had planned on hiding away the official seals of the empire that were needed for the coronation, though his advisors warned him that new seals would just be made to replace any he had stolen. Luckily for Puyi, the new empire under Yuan Shikai was very short-lived. Almost as soon as he was crowned emperor, the rest of the country rebelled against his rule. Japan even stepped in to allow its citizens to fight on the side of the Republicans. In March of 1916, Yuan dismantled his empire and the Republic was restored. Just a few months later, Yuan Shikai was dead. China fell into a state of anarchy. Local warlords rose up across the different provinces of China, all vying for who would be the next president of the republic. But one of these warlords, a man named Zhang Shun, had a different idea for how China could move forward. Zhang had always maintained some level of loyalty to the Qing dynasty, even if he was serving as a general in the republic's army. In July of 1917, Zhang marched into Beijing and formally proclaimed that he was restoring Puyi to the throne of emperor. Under the Republic, people of Manchu and Mongolian ethnicity had felt they were being discriminated against. If the Qing were once more in charge, this would help soothe that fear. And even though literally no one except for Zhang's troops and the people in the Forbidden City recognized this restoration of the Qing, popular history does technically allow the Manchu Restoration, as it is now known, to count as a second reign for Puyi. But, like I said, no one else recognized Puyi as once more being emperor. Republican forces then led an air raid over the Forbidden City, dropping several bombs. Only one person was killed, but it was enough to let everyone know that this new Qing reign was over before it had even started. After a reign of just 11 days, Puyi was once more forced to abdicate the throne, this time truly as the last emperor of China. Let's now skip forward several years. During this time, Puyi's life continued much as it had before the Manchu Restoration. He lived in the Forbidden City, was treated like a noble within the walls, but was otherwise technically just a living relic of a bygone era. In 1922, due to pressure from the court concubines of the former emperors, Puyi was married to Gobolo Wanrong, the daughter of a Manchurian aristocrat. Though he was technically not emperor, Wanrong has historically been referred to as the Xuantong Empress. Then, in September of 1923, a massive earthquake struck Japan, destroying parts of Tokyo and resulting in thousands of deaths. In the aftermath of the earthquake, Puyi donated Qing antiques that were worth about $2.1 million in 2024, which is about 1.7 British pounds and 1.9 million euro. This charity on the emperor's part would begin the long journey ahead between Puyi and his eastern neighbor. Puyi would need that relationship almost immediately because, in 1924, provincial warlord Fang Yuxiang decided China no longer needed to be paying for the expenses of an emperor who no longer had any power. After all, the Forbidden City had fallen into disrepair over the years, mostly due to Puyi firing a massive majority of the court eunuchs whose job it was to keep the palace together. In November of that year, Fang took over the Forbidden City, evicted the imperial family, and stripped Puyi of all his titles. Though he had technically not been emperor in years, Puyi had finally been reduced to a normal citizen of the Republic. A citizen with vast amounts of wealth and a social network that almost no one in the nation could match, but a citizen nonetheless. While he originally moved with his wife into the mansion of his father, Puyi's place of birth, he would later be offered a place in the city of Tianjin, a section of China that had been given to the Japanese Empire. During this time, many of the local warlords, as well as some foreign powers and members of his extended family, would visit the former emperor and ask for money to fund various war efforts and other expenses. Puyi was meanwhile living quite the lavish life as a very rich private citizen. He became very interested in more Western luxuries. Meanwhile, Empress Wanrong became more detached from her husband. She would often sneak off to nightclubs to avoid her husband. She also became addicted to opium. Puyi, shockingly, did not particularly care. In 1931, his concubine named Wen Xiu decided she too could no longer stand living with a former emperor who had become lax in his lifestyle. She filed for divorce from Puyi, becoming the only Qing dynasty concubine to do so. Also in 1931, Japan decided to up its game of imperial expansion. It decided upon the region of Manchuria, the homeland of the Qing. Japan blew up its own railroad in Manchuria and blamed it on a local warlord, seemingly giving the empire legitimacy for its invasion of the region. However, due to international laws, Japan could not actually annex the region into its empire. Instead, it transformed Manchuria into a puppet state under its control that became known as Manchukuo. However, Japan would need a loyal ally of Manchurian descent who could be placed in charge of the region. The obvious choice was Puyi, who had established a relationship with the empire. Puyi was interested in the offer, but Wan Rong was hesitant and told her husband that choice would amount to treason against China. Luckily, Japan had a few weapons in its arsenal. First, it hired a local cafe worker to convince Puyi that a warrant was out for his arrest. With the former emperor now paranoid, Japan unleashed Yoshiko Kawashima. She was actually a cousin of the emperor who had been adopted by a Japanese official, which is why she had a very Japanese name. As she was pro-Japan, she managed to convince her cousin that this was the right thing to do. Also, Yoshiko Kawashima was an incredibly interesting woman. I don't have all the time to talk about her here, but you really should look her up for an interesting story. Puyi was now convinced that Manchukuo was the best course of action. Unfortunately, Wan Rong was right. As soon as it became known that Puyi was falling into Japan's hands, he was charged with treason. The final emperor of the Qing had to be snuck into Manchukuo in the trunk of a car. However, he did in fact make it there safely. And in Manchukuo, he found a new life waiting for him. A life he thought would fulfill his desire to regain the power of an emperor. Almost immediately, it was clear that things were not going back to the glory days of the Qing dynasty. That should have been apparent when Puyi had to be smuggled into Manchukuo. He was essentially held under house arrest within a hotel, though the reason was given that this was to prevent him from any assassination attempts. Meanwhile, Empress Wan Rong was still living in the Republic of China. Once again, it was up to Yoshiko Kawashima. She convinced the anachronistic empress that it was her duty as Puyi's wife to join him in Manchukuo. Eventually, she relented and was brought to join her husband. Within a couple months, the Japanese generals, who were essentially Puyi's overseers, told him the truth of the situation. Manchukuo would not be a monarchy, but a republic with Puyi as a chief executive, not an emperor. There would be no mention of the Mandate of Heaven, the concept of the Chinese monarchy that said the ruler of China was chosen by the divine power of a heavenly authority. Obviously, Puyi was upset by this revelation. He attempted to negotiate with the Japanese authorities, but they shot down his suggestions, one of which was having the capital of Manchukuo be the city of Mukden, modern-day Shenyang, the historical capital of the Manchu people. Note, the capital would instead be the industry-centered municipality of Changchun. Puyi was slightly appeased when he was told that Manchukuo was just the beginning. Perhaps in a few years, the republic could become a monarchy. And after that, he could possibly lead a campaign to reclaim the rest of China. On the 1st of March 1932, Puyi was named as chief executive, having given in to the demands of Japan. From then on, he would fully act as Japan's puppet to ensure imperialistic desires in China. From his own position, Puyi still believed that he would one day be emperor of China in a not-too-distant future. He had imperial artifacts and clothing shipped from Beijing to prepare for his future dream. However, Puyi's present was very much not a dream state. The people of Manchukuo were very much not on board with the new arrangement. Throughout the entire time since Japan had declared war, Manchurian guerrilla fighters had maintained a combative front. The citizens themselves grew to despise Puyi. Even his wife slipped further into depressive episodes and opium addiction. Puyi's cooperation ultimately resulted in Emperor Hirohito of Japan deciding that his puppet had played his role well enough for the time being. In late 1933, Puyi was told he would once more be named emperor, which obviously made him very excited. Unfortunately, as he soon found out, he would not be renamed the Qing Emperor. No, exactly 2 years after he was named chief executive, Puyi was crowned as Emperor of Manchukuo. Puyi's enthronement as Emperor of Manchukuo was made with many concessions I'm sure the emperor would have loved to have done without. The Japanese wanted him to dress in the style of the Manchukuo army. Puyi had wanted to wear traditional Manchu clothing, so instead he opted to wear a more European style of military uniform. He was also given an ascension ceremony at a makeshift Temple of Heaven, the temple used in the traditional enthronement ceremonies of Chinese emperors. Empress Wanrong, as she had come to be constantly, was very upset during the ceremony. After his coronation ceremony, Puyi's father arrived in Manchukuo to meet with his son. The new emperor's father berated his son for falling for Japan's obvious game. He would be a puppet, never getting anything close to the power he'd had as the Qing emperor. And Puyi's father would be correct. Even from the earliest days of his reign, it was clear that Puyi had no true sense of autonomy as the emperor of Manchukuo. He only received news that the Japanese military officers found necessary to tell him. He wasn't even able to leave his palace unless he was given permission. And speaking of his palace, it had actually once been an office for the collection of a salt tax in the Chinese province of Jilin, which caused the palace to be disparagingly known as the Salt Tax Palace. Puyi had to perform Japanese rituals to honor Japanese soldiers who had been killed by Manchurian guerrilla soldiers. He signed laws brought to him by Japanese officials they wanted him to put into effect. Over the years, this led Puyi to slide into a darker place mentally and spiritually. He would order for his servants to be beaten. It became so prevalent that the phrase, "take him downstairs," was shorthand for a servant being ordered to be beaten, which was said to happen at least once per day. Empress Wanrong continued to dislike her husband more and more to the point where she would mock him behind his back by dressing up as the emperor and imitating his growing physical weakness. Puyi was not a good husband, though. As was the case for most monarchs in history, Puyi was allowed to have as many affairs as he wanted, but his wife could not. When Puyi found out that his wife was pregnant through an affair, he ordered for the baby to be killed. And the worst part is that we don't even know if Wanrong ever found out. Apparently, Puyi lied and said the child was being taken into the care of a nanny and Wanrong would just never see her child again. However, Puyi's personal life would get a massive change when the Japanese Empire once more started an aggressive push to claim parts of China. However, the Chinese people would very much fight back. Things eventually escalated, and war broke out in 1937. The war we now call the Second Sino-Japanese War. Unlike the First Sino-Japanese War, China was no longer an empire. Not only that, but the Chinese people weren't even fighting on a united front. A decade before the Second Sino-Japanese War began, China had entered into its own civil war. On one side was the Nationalist Chinese Party looking to uphold the Republic. On the other side was the Communist Party of China, obviously with the goal of turning China into a communist nation. Luckily, both sides agreed that they couldn't let Japan gain control of their country. And how did this affect Puyi? Well, as a man who had once ruled China but was now a Japanese puppet, he was put in a precarious place. Obviously, he supported Japan in the war. Under the guidance of Japanese generals, Puyi issued imperial decrees to greatly expand Manchukuo industrial output in order to help Japan. This meant greatly relying on slave labor in order to reduce the cost of paying workers. It is estimated that throughout the war, which lasted up to the end of World War II, about 1 million Chinese citizens were sold into slavery per year. In order to help rally morale among the people in Manchukuo, the Japanese allowed Puyi to be elevated to the level of a living god. It was in their opinion that more people would be willing to risk their lives in total war, war without a goal other than complete victory, if they worshipped a god king. This originally made Puyi incredibly happy until Japan created another puppet state out of a land they controlled in China. This new development finally made Puyi realize that he could never be the Qing emperor again. Outside of Manchukuo, the world was falling apart as World War II had begun. As to be expected, Puyi was almost never allowed to leave his palace and was constantly fed Japanese propaganda about the war. The Manchurian Emperor even went so far as to declare war on the US and the UK in 1941. Unfortunately for Puyi, neither of those nations recognized Manchukuo as a sovereign nation, so that didn't really amount to all that much. And actually, outside Japan's allies and the Axis powers of World War II, very few countries recognized any sort of legitimacy to Manchukuo. Puyi very much believed Japan was winning in both the Second Sino-Japanese War and World War II until around 1944 when he started hearing about sacrifices on the side of Japan. Apparently, this allowed the emperor to become disillusioned with his overseers. Unfortunately, he had spoken out in favor of Japan so much in the past that he was certain none of the Allied powers would accept him if he wanted to be free. Then, in 1945, the Soviet Union declared war on Japan and marched into Manchukuo. Puyi was assured that the USSR would be defeated soon enough, but that very much did not end up being the case. On the 11th of August, Puyi was forced to flee his palace and capital city. A few days later on the 15th, he finally heard news that 1. Japan was surrendering in the war, and 2. The US had dropped 2 atomic bombs on Japan. Apparently, his handlers hadn't decided to mention that bit of destructive news a week before when it happened. Well, seeing the writing on the wall, on the 17th of August, 1945, Puyi abdicated as Emperor of Manchukuo. His final imperial decree was that Manchukuo was once more a part of China. Almost immediately afterwards, Puyi, his wife, and many other members of his regime were taken as prisoners by the Soviet Union. After briefly living as a god emperor, for all the good that might have done, Puyi was now reduced to nothing. Puyi was held as a prisoner in a Siberian camp. The Soviets refused to give up the former emperor to China, which ultimately saved Puyi's life while the Chinese Civil War picked up once more without Japan's interference. Chiang Kai-shek, the leader of the National Party of China, had often spoken about his desire to see Puyi killed. Meanwhile, in mid-1946, Lady Wan Rong passed away from starvation after a life of pain and opium addiction. Puyi would not find out about his wife's death until several years later. Also in 1946, Puyi had to testify at the International Military Tribunal for the Far East, the series of trials conducted to convict Japan and its eastern allies of war crimes in World War II. When Puyi took the stand, he tried to make himself seem innocent, denying any true connections he had to Japan. He wanted everyone to believe he was just a man being played by Japan. Which, I mean, well, he was, but Puyi had never really lived that way. Everyone kinda knew he was lying, but they couldn't prove it, so Puyi was allowed to live. Meanwhile, the Chinese Civil War had started moving in favor of the Chinese Communist Party. As we know, the CCP would eventually win that war. The National Party would retreat to Taiwan and set up their government there, with the nation of Taiwan still considering itself the true Republic of China. The Soviets had promised the CCP that they would release Puyi if the Communists won the Civil War. So, when the CCP took power in 1949, Puyi was transferred from a Soviet prison camp to a Chinese one. The leaders of the CCP wanted Puyi kept alive while others from his administration were killed. They believed that if they could reform a man born into royalty to become a communist, they could use that as a powerful propaganda piece. For the first time in his life, Puyi was denied servants, and yeah, he still had those in the Soviet prison camp. He was given an education on Marxism-Leninism while being paraded around to see the atrocities Japan had unleashed on the Chinese people. Puyi was greatly disturbed by this latter part, as he knew a lot of this was done using his name. Unfortunately, the New People's Republic of China was not without its own faults. Puyi's field trips made sure to avoid areas where mass famine had broken out, as the government thought it would lessen Puyi's communist indoctrination. But after a decade in a PROC camp, Puyi was finally allowed to live as a citizen in Beijing in his younger sister's home. No longer royalty, just a man. According to a biography of Puyi written by journalist Edward Baer, Puyi was tasked with being a street sweeper. On his first day, he got lost on his way home and had to tell a random citizen, "I'm Puyi, the last emperor of the Qing dynasty. I'm staying with relatives and can't find my way home." However, despite his new simple lifestyle, it seemed as if Puyi had truly changed his ways. He constantly recalled how ashamed he was of his past and how important communism had become for China. In humility, he was allowed to live out the rest of his life in peace. While mostly living a quiet life, occasionally Puyi would be brought out by the CCP as a spectacle for foreign diplomats visiting the nation who wanted to see China's last emperor. In 1960, with encouragement from Premier Zhou Enlai and Chairman Mao Zedong, Puyi had been allowed to publish his life story, albeit ghostwritten by Li Wenda, an editor for the People's Publishing Bureau. After 4 years, the book, From Emperor to Citizen, was published. The book very much does not tell the whole truth of Puyi's life. The government even went so far as to further edit the book, the full version only being re-released in 2007. When the book became too popular outside of China, the government arrested Li Wenda and held him prisoner for 7 years. However, Puyi was allowed to survive free until his death. After years of being pampered and free to live out any sadistic dream against his servants he wished, the former emperor passed away in 1967 at the age of 61. With his death, the age of Imperial China truly died out. But for now, that's it for this week's episode of Royally Screwed. I hope you enjoyed the journey. Be sure to subscribe to the show and tell a friend all about it. Next time, we're going to talk about Rollo, a figure from the Viking era whose actions in medieval France would end up having a lasting impact on the future of Europe as a whole for centuries to come. I hope you'll join me then for another topsy-turvy look into history's most interesting rulers.